We have to get started to get home tonight. My name is Kjell Kjeldsen. I'm a professor of cardiology and a clinical cardiology cardiologist from Denmark. It is a pleasure for me to say that we are endorsing CVCT, as you may have seen from the program. We'll also have to leave before this session ends due to logistic problems. But my co-chairman will stay and will manage to be chairman and speaker. Jayan, please present yourself.
I welcome all the attendees, those in the room and those connected through the web. And I hope we will have a good session, although we are very few left.
The first speaker will speak on insights from dose and gap in evidence with diuretic therapy. Speaker is Alice Machetti from National Heart, Lung and Blood Institute in the U.S.
Thank you, Dr. Kjeldsen and Dr. Rossi. Thank you, Dr. Pitt and the CVCT organizers, as well as those of you who have stuck with us to this late session on a Saturday evening in Paris. I give you great credit. I'm here as a representative of the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, and more specifically as the program director within that institute for the funded Heart Failure Network, which is a network of investigators that we fund to put together a series of clinical trials and run them concurrently. It has a large organizational structure that I won't belabor here. I do want to thank and point out Dr. Bill Abraham, who is the chair of our protocol review committee. Within this network, as the investigators come up with new ideas for proposing research, all of those potential trials go through a protocol review committee in addition to a data safety monitoring board and in addition to the individual institutional review boards or ethics committees at the various sites. These are the sites currently involved in the Heart Failure Network. We are in our renewal period, so some of these sites are new this year, and others have been with us since the group was first funded 5 years ago, now 6 years ago, excuse me. We are very, very fortunate to have as the study chairman for our group, Dr. Gene Brunwald, known to everyone, needs no other introduction. Dr. Brunwald is a very engaged study chair, and certainly our protocols reflect his experience, his knowledge, and his engagement. So this network is a bunch of investigators, very excellent investigators, who have achieved their place at the table by going through peer review at the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. But once they're there at the table, that's when the decisions are made about what studies to perform, and then the group gets together to collaboratively work on a study protocol. So the first study that we got out of the door in the Heart Failure Network was the DOSE trial. And you might ask yourself, diuretics, they're simple. We use them all the time. Why start there? Well, I think part of the reason for why starting there is the fact that there has been so little formally studied about diuretic therapy. If asked what the correct dose is for a patient in acute heart failure, the answer is probably enough. And in fact, there's kind of a standing joke, at least in the U.S. I don't know if this made its way to Europe, but when I was a medical student in the 70s, a popular satirical novel was The House of God, that had kind of all of these crazy rules of treating patients in kind of a sarcastic way. I had to put up there, warning, this is satire. I don't want this showing up in Grand Rounds somewhere, since this is being telecast. But, you know, the joke from House of God was to determine the Lasix dose. So you took someone's age plus their blood, urea, nitrogen, and gave them that much. That's about, you know, other than learning at the knee of your resident, that's about what people have said about Lasix dosing. Nonetheless, the DOSE trial was performed and made its way into the New England Journal of Medicine. The slides I'll be showing are really the brainchilds of Dr. Mike Felker, Dr. Chris O'Connor, who are both on the faculty. I failed to circle Dr. Adrian Hernandez, who's the current principal investigator for the coordinating center. And this study was chosen by the American Heart Association Council on Clinical Cardiology is one of the top 10 advances for the year 2011. They haven't named 2012 yet. So the dose study design, and again, these are Mike Felker's slides from when this was presented at ACC 2 years ago, where people in acute heart failure trying to get enrolled within 24 hours of admission. It was a 2x2 factorial randomization that took into account the use of either high dose or usual dose Lasix, and we predicated that on what their standing oral dose was because we had no standard dose, and continuous infusion versus IV bolus therapy. This study was blinded, double-blinded, I should say. All patients had an IV drip running, and they all received syringes of fluid that were either Lasix or weren't. Then after 48 hours, individual clinicians could change to what they felt the patient actually needed. This was a concession to the fact that clinicians, investigators, were unlikely to continue to drive along for much further under a protocolized unknown treatment, particularly if the patient was not doing well. The primary endpoint was a co-primary endpoint at 72 hours, which was the change in creatinine, and our earlier session talked a lot about the area under the curve for the VAS over a 72-hour period. Again, these results were already shown by Dr. Felker at ACC. When comparing continuous infusion versus IV boluses, there really was no difference in the dyspnea score as measured by the area under the curve of the VAS. The same was true for the low-dose versus high-dose therapy, although there was a trend towards a little bit of improvement with the high dose. Remember, because we have two endpoints, our P here was actually 0.025 for significance, so this is not as close to significant as it might appear on first blush. The change in creatinine, similarly, was really not significantly different between the bolus therapy and the continuous therapy, nor between the low and the high doses. Death and rehospitalization were pretty much same in both of the factorial design interventions. Oh, I reached the point where everyone... Okay, so there was no statistically significant difference for either of the interventional types. In the interest of time, I did not discuss all the secondary endpoints that were presented at the ACC and are available in the paper discussion. But the high intensification or the high dose therapy was associated with trends toward greater improvement in a number of the secondary endpoints, such as symptom relief, weight loss, net volume loss, the number of patients free from congestion, and reduction in NT-proBNP. There was some worsening renal function at 72 hours at the higher dose therapy, but these did not persist over time. And the conclusion of the investigators was that the preferred initial strategy may well be the high dose, with no particular recommendation made for continuous versus bolus. The Heart Failure Network has continued to work in the realm of diuresis amongst other studies that are ongoing, but the second trial to be completed, and I should say these are two trials completed. We have one trial that has just locked the database that we hope to present at the next major meeting. We have two under kind of coming to their last stage of enrollment, and five under development for the new period. So it's been a pretty busy group, and it's a group that does a lot of multitasking. So this is the CREST trial that was recently presented at the American Heart Association. It has been published in New England Journal online so far. We'll have to check with Dr. Jarko when we will have the print publication. We expect soon. And many of you may have known this since this was fairly recently presented. This, again, was patients presenting with acute heart failure with worsening renal function and persistent congestion, and they were randomized in a non-blinded way to pharmacologic care versus ultrafiltration. The individual clinician was able to stop therapy when they felt that the patient had cleared up well enough to the clinician's satisfaction, and endpoints were assessed at 96 hours after randomization. That's the primary endpoint, and outcomes were also assessed at 60 days. The primary endpoint was a dual endpoint, a composite endpoint of change in serum creatinine and change in weight between randomization and 96 hours. So it was both a efficacy and a safety parameter combined into both, and the usual intention to treat analysis was performed, as well as adjusting for baseline values of weight and creatinine. These are the results shown at AHA, and again, these were shown by Dr. Brad Bart on behalf of the network. For the pharmacologic care, there was a weight loss. If you follow from the along the x-axis to the left, there was a weight loss of approximately 12 pounds on average, with really no change in creatinine on the y-axis, or if anything, a very minimal decrease in creatinine. To the surprise of the investigators, the ultrafiltration arm had similar weight loss, but actually an increase in creatinine as measured at the pre-specified endpoint. And this was statistically significant. For this bivariate type of analysis, instead of seeing confidence intervals that are linear, we have confidence regions which are ovoid, and these are the 95% confidence limits and a statistically significant result. Looking at some of this data a little bit more specifically, this is the change in weight from baseline a little bit early on, a little bit more volume off with the ultrafiltration, but pretty much evened out at 96 hours, and fairly similar even out, excuse me, to days. However, the change in creatinine was fairly consistently in the correct direction, in other words, an improvement in creatinine, a downward trend in creatinine for the pharmacologic care group, whereas for the ultrafiltration group, it rose over the 96-hour period. It stayed high at 7 days relative to pharmacologic care, and even 30 and 60 days out, although now in both cases the creatinine was somewhat improved, the improvement was greater in the pharmacologic care group. All the places where there's an asterisk were statistically significant at p less than 0.05. These are the 60-day event rates. The left one was a pre-specified endpoint. The one to the right was not, but it was this excess of death or serious adverse events in the treatment group, that is the ultrafiltration group, that prompted our Data Safety Monitoring Board to halt the study a mere 12 patients before the pre-specified plan for 200 patients. They felt that there was to be no further likelihood of change in the primary endpoints with a growing concern for death and adverse events. Those adverse events, I might say, were considered, included some rather serious things such as SBE, fungemia, which I believe was the same patient, a number of bleeding events, et cetera. So the conclusions as presented by Dr. Bard is that the pharmacologic care was superior to ultrafiltration as administered in this study, but recognize that these patients are a challenging clinical problem in need of better therapy. I do want to make one point about the stepped pharmacologic care. This was not just usual care, and this study differs from the prior UNLOAD study in that the investigators were prompted to have a very vigorous diuresis so that the change in volume taken off would not be the prime determinant of the outcomes of the study. So the diuretics were adjusted up to keep good urine output. If still inadequate, dopamine or dobutamine were allowable, or consideration of nitroglycerin or niseretide. So in setting up this session, I was also asked to mention what gaps exist as we talk about a couple of studies that we have performed. I wanted to point out two things here. This is from the dose table of secondary endpoints. And I think one very obvious gap is that the people, the percentage of patients free from congestion at 72 hours was 14 or 15%. in other words, not very good. Here we are in a clinical trial. This is the dose study, in a clinical trial where we are actively diuresing people and where patients got to the point where their clinicians felt they were doing pretty well. But even with that, when looking at the objective measure of freedom from pulmonary congestion, freedom from jugular venous distension, and lack of edema, a really small percentage of patients were doing as well as we one would hope. And that was also probably true if you look at the, if I won't go back in the interest of time, but even as we're looking at the improvement in dyspnea, the number of people who truly feel like they are feeling awfully good at the time when the clinician thinks they're feeling awfully good, that there's a disparity there. So let's look at ultrafiltration, the same line item from the CARES study. You know, here we even have ultrafiltration there to help us get people really decongested, and again, 10% at 96 hours. So is it that we aren't treating well? Is that we don't know how to measure when we have treated well? You could say, well, maybe we need better measurements of when someone's decongested, but as the ESCAPE study showed us, the addition, at least of routine use of pulmonary artery catheters to measure wedge pressure really didn't help treatment despite the expectations that it would. This morning, or not this morning, but the earlier session talked about dyspnea and how we measure it and which of the many scales of dyspnea are helpful for us to know when a patient has improved either in a clinical study or in regular everyday clinical life. This publication includes a lot of folks, I think, that came out of CVT, or there's a lot of overlap with people who are here, as well as people who were at this other session organized in Europe, to consider provocative dyspnea scores, to provoke dyspnea either by various positions or having people walk around. In fact, in one of our current clinical trials in acute heart failure that we're doing in the Heart Failure Network, a group of the funded fellows they're not funded actually, but the teaching of clinical skills is part of this network's superstructure. The fellows have instituted a look at this to try to determine, as an ancillary study to the ROSE trial, which is another acute heart failure trial, just which of these dyspnea scores is more correlated with outcomes that we see as harder endpoints. So are there gaps? I would say yes, there are plenty. I think these two studies have shown that even when we're working really hard in a clinical study, and that might be much more formalized than even in clinical practice, our ability to decongest is suboptimal and really hasn't changed since I was a medical student reading House of God in the 1970s, other than no one uses tourniquets anymore. That's about it. And our assessment tools are suboptimal. Physical exam, if we are to believe it, really only identifies that a very small proportion of our patients really are a whole lot better after our acute excellent management. Hemodynamics, as per the ESCAPE trial, show that that doesn't add enough to make their routine use acceptable. And we really have no good way to assess our key symptom of dyspnea. So there's plenty of gaps, there's plenty on horizon, and that will, I think, tee it off for the next speakers to tell us how we solve all this. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Alice Machetti, for this interesting presentation. Anyone from the panel wants to raise questions?
I have a question. What we've learned from the Everest trial clearly that creatinine and body weight are not surrogate endpoints. Because what we've seen in Everest clearly that we have a major reduction in body weight with the safe drug throughout months, and that did not translate to improve outcome. And the reason that is happening, because body weight, it's a reflection of total body water. What matters is the intravascular volume. So aesthetically, you can decrease the body weight. Tolvaptan or other vasopressin non-steroid antagonists will decrease the total body water. But if you measure serum osmolarity, it's increased, intravascular volume, it's increased, and we have a paper now in preparation on the single most important predictor is the intravascular volume, what happened during hospital. So I think the body weight, it's very, very misleading because it's not telling us where the water is coming from. The water may come from the intravascular space, may come from, like with nifedipine, it's not intravascular. With anti-diabetic agents, it's not intravascular, so I have to be very careful. At the same time, we've learned over the years that increasing creatinine may be transient, and as Dr. Remuzzi, who's a famous nephrologist, said, worry about the heart and not worry about the kidney. It's a vasomotor nephropathy, and guess what? After 96 hours, this worsening creatinine, when the patient's gaining weight, is going back to the pre. That's not injury. There's no correlation between injury and creatinine. You have increasing creatinine clearance or decrease, no injury, and vice versa. So I'm a little bit skeptical that a study of 200 or 300 patients can change the practice at this point in time.
I know that the use of creatinine is indeed controversial, but I believe that it has been a guide for clinical practice for many a year. The study was designed, I think we're referring to Caress in this case, the study was designed by people who really believed that ultrafiltration would likely come out on top. And the endpoints were chosen, I believe, to show that benefit. So I think it's a little unfair. I think when we design a clinical trial, right or wrong, we choose an endpoint. If that endpoint is not met, I'm not sure that it's fair to then at that point say, well, that was a not good endpoint. The people who designed the trial are great advocates of ultrafiltration and felt that endpoint would be show the obvious advantage of ultrafiltration.
Simply what I'm saying, that should not be definitive data. I do agree with you that you can raise the hypothesis, but many individuals are looking at CARES as definitive data. In other words, there's no after CARES. I was never a proponent of ultrafiltration. If anything, I was extremely critical of UNLOAD. So I'm not coming from the group that favor ultrafiltration. But as a trialist, I'm kind of perplexed that many of my colleagues are taking this as a definitive and conclusive data. This is a big responsibility to remove a form of therapy from our armamentarium.
Dr. Felker, please go ahead.
So I appreciate Mihai's comment, one regarding our difficulties in measuring what we really want to measure, which is congestion. We don't have body weight, I agree, is a poor surrogate. What I'd like to point out about CARES and DOSE both is that they're really comparative effectiveness studies of therapies that are already being used every day. So tomorrow people are going to give diuretics and they have to figure out how they want to give them, and they're going to consider whether they're going to use ultrafiltration or not. So I'm not sure that CARES is a definitive study, but I do think if CARES was a new drug and you did a phase 2 trial and you saw a 50% increase in adverse events, even in a 300-patient trial, an increase in creatinine, and no evidence of efficacy, no evidence suggesting it was any better, and you have a lot of experience in drug development, I suspect you would say we should go do something else instead of pursuing this in a bigger study. So I think it's not definitive, but as Dr. Bromwell said, it's kind of hard to look at the CARES database and find something good to say about ultrafiltration.
Can I be provocative to you? Do you think that the algorithm for the stepped increase in diuretic treatment in CARES reflects really what's going on in the U.S. and Europe as well?
Well, that might be like criticizing a study for using optimal medical therapy in the good arm when you're comparing a new drug to ACE inhibitors and beta blockers. Perhaps it's not the way everyone is performing their diuresis, but certainly it's a way everyone can perform diuresis, and
I don't know if I should go as far as to say should, because again, it is a small study. But it's certainly doable. We had no magic tricks or magic wands. It was based on what people are generally doing, but it was just in a formalized fashion so that we knew all the sites were doing it as well. I just also wanted to add on to Dr. Felker's comment. Not only did we not see benefit and we saw adverse events, the one thing that also wasn't mentioned is it's a costly therapy. And you said a drug wouldn't necessarily pass to a phase 3 trial with that kind of data. I'd say even if the drug were free, it wouldn't pass to that type of next stage. And yet we're talking about something that is invasive, is expensive, involves risk, and yet we await the benefit. I agree, maybe it's not the definitive study, but maybe people should not be using it without definitive evidence of benefit.
I will really take issue with what Dr. Felker said, because he knows more than I do that every single phase 2 trial conducted to date in this area did not predict the results of the phase 3. If you look at our active HF in tolvaptan, was highly, highly positive. I can give you example after example, and Dr. Felker knows
But Mihai, as you said earlier today, there's a difference between efficacy and harm. So you're right, they didn't predict efficacy, but if you have a phase 2 trial that shows clear suggestion of harm, in general, we don't pursue those into phase 3 because there's a lot of drug targets, and I agree, but I think if you have a safety signal in phase 2 that's quite significant, then that, and no evidence of efficacy, then it's hard to say this is a therapy should be advanced.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Bob Cody,
please. Yeah, just two questions. First of all, I mean, any device that's rapidly removing fluid can cause compartment shifts. So is there any sense of the rate that the fluid was taken off with the ultrafiltration, even compared to the rate of diuresis that was seen with the Lasix? And did that impact the creatinine? Could the creatinine bump have been avoided if fluid was taken off less rapidly?
You will have the answer to this in my presentation later on until the end.
I will, so that takes care of question one. And thanks. Question two, this is not a phase 2 study. This device has been on the market for several years, correct? So there must be a post-marketing safety database on this. Did the adverse effects in this study reflect what was being seen in the database through the company? I'm sure the study investigators must have queried the company as to the extent to which sepsis, SBE, et cetera, have been seen in their database. And what's the answer to that?
We were not, the industry was not a part.
Well, yeah, I understand that, but one could have called them and said, we saw this in the study, and does this match what you've seen with the device in the commercial space?
But at least what could be said is that the complication rate in CARES was far higher than in euphoria and unload, and that's a real fact. And on top of that, we should add that the trial was terminated before schedule because of this high rate of complication and presumed lack of efficacy. So there is a question from Brazil, Japan,
yeah.
I don't know.
Yes, indeed, a question from Brazil to the expert panel. This is how to measure intravascular volume in routine clinical practice, according to you.
Bert Pitt probably wants to respond to that.
Well, I don't think we know how to measure intravascular volume very well. I think there are various formulas for looking at changes in volume by hematocrit and hemoglobin, and we have BNP and other biomarkers, but what we really need is some measures of absolute volume, and there are some measures using radioisotopes, but they've been only employed in small numbers, and I don't think we know enough about it. So I don't think we really know how to answer that question, but it's obviously critical that we know from several studies that clinically we don't have very good ability by physical signs to really estimate volume, and we've all been fooled by someone whose RALs are down, but yet there's evidence of marked volume overload, and even things like BNP have a lot of variability depending on weight, renal function, et cetera. So I think it's something we need to pay attention to if we're going to do studies such as this and know where to go. And obviously this study didn't work, but the question is, did it work because the strategy is bad in general, or maybe it wasn't done right? Maybe we don't know how to do it.
Actually, you can measure plasma volume by radio-labeled albumin techniques.
Yes.
And we did this in the 80s, and Bill Abraham maybe did this back in his days with Dr. Schreier. But it's interesting that the amount of peripheral or perceived edema on physical exam doesn't predict plasma volume. You could have plasma volume that's expanded, you could have plasma volume that's normal, and you could have plasma volume that's contracted even in the presence of edema. So I don't know if Bill has any thoughts on that from his days.
There are now automated radioisotope techniques that make this very easy to do at the bedside, and one could postulate that it might be better to, knowing what normal volume is, to titrate either your medical therapy or your ultrafiltration to a normal volume, and avoiding hypovolemia, which may cause some of these adverse events. So I think there's a lot to learn, and I think this is a very interesting study, but I don't think it's the end of our sort of knowledge about ultrafiltration.
Thank you.